Welcome to this special hour-long edition of the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher, and my guest today is Congressman John Katko. He represents New York's 24th Congressional District, which includes all of Cayuga, Onondaga, and Wayne counties, and the western portion of Oswego County, including the cities of Oswego and Fulton. He's currently serving in his second term. Prior to our conversation here today and using WRVO's social media channels, we asked our listeners to suggest questions, and to our pleasant surprise, we received almost 100 responses. So obviously, we can't incorporate them all into the program, but I've channeled the spirit of as many of them as I can into what follows. Congressman Katko, welcome back to the program.
Thanks. I'm glad to be back here again. I can't remember how many times it's been now. It's been quite a few.
Yeah, but we have to keep it going.
Absolutely.
And I want to spend some time in this conversation, obviously, on the new tax law. It's the most significant piece of legislation so far in the Trump presidency and for this particular Congress. The Republican New York State congressional delegation was split on this to some extent. And so I wanted to start with a very open-ended question for you. Could you just walk me through your decision-making process on the final vote, the pros and the cons as you saw them, how you weighed them, and then how you ultimately arrived at a yes vote?
Sure, yeah, and I appreciate giving me the opportunity to explain that because there's been an awful lot out there that's misinformation, and I'm glad to have the opportunity. You know, it boils down to, was it a good deal for the vast majority of my constituents? And my answer to that is a resounding yes. And I reached that conclusion by two simple things. Number one is, it's a fact that the vast majority of my constituents are going to get a tax break of some sort. And the second thing is that I looked at the economy in central New York, and I am adamant that we can't just maintain the status quo. And maintaining the status quo is not going to get us anywhere. And I looked at the last 20 or 30 years in central New York, and we lost 20, 30,000 manufacturing jobs, a good chunk of which went overseas. And it went overseas because we weren't competitive. And so, yes, it's a tax break for my constituents, but the second prong is equally important, and that is it's going to give businesses the opportunity to stay here, give businesses the opportunity to come back here, and give the businesses the opportunity to compete on the world stage. And I visited, I can't tell you how many manufacturers, for example, and they tell me two things. One is the regulatory scheme is killing them, their competitiveness overseas, and two, their tax structure is killing them. We have one of the highest tax structures, or had one of the highest tax structures for businesses in the industrialized world. We went from having one of the worst tax structures, the highest ones, to one of the best ones, and that is going to help us compete overseas. And so I wanted, you know, with our poverty issues here, I think this is the best chance we've had in a long time to try and turn that dynamic around by providing entry-level jobs into the economy that's going to get them out of poverty and at the same time give the working class people a tax break.
Now, there were a lot of features of this tax bill as it worked its way through that had concern for different constituencies in
this area.
And across the country. And so I wanted to explore some of those with you and in different ways. So let me start with this way. Were there specific aspects of the final version that had they not been changed from the earlier versions would have been deal breakers for you? I mean, was there kind of a point where you said, okay, you know, I had these concerns, but now I'm going to go with this thing? I don't know if that question makes sense.
It does make sense. And I can tell you, when I saw early drafts of the bill and I was getting told what the early contours of the bill were, I had real concerns. And I spent, I can't tell you how many late nights at the Capitol with leadership. And I got to credit leadership. They paid attention to us, and those of us in the high-tax states. And one of the big things I said was, unless you do something to get some sort of property tax provision back in there that you can write off, I can't be a part of this. And so I was instrumental in getting the $10,000 property tax deduction back in there. And what people don't understand is, like, well, I'm losing this deduction, I'm losing that deduction. Well, the vast majority of people now won't have to worry about deductions because the standard deductions, or itemizing rather, because the standard deductions are so big.
Mm-hmm. So basically doubled.
From $6,000 to $12,000 for an individual and $12,000 to $24,000 for a married couple. Mm-hmm. Now, if you factor that in, a lot of these deductions that people are concerned about are becoming irrelevant. But be that as it may, I did want to get the property tax deduction back instated, and it got reinstated at $10,000. So you can still take, if you choose to itemize, your $10,000 property tax deduction or some combination or equivalent of income tax. Plus, you can take deductions of over $500,000, I believe, in interest income. for your home. Mm-hmm. And then on top of that, you can do charitable deductions. So you can do that route, or you can go to standard deduction route, which based on what every statistic I've seen, 90 to 95% of my constituents will now take the standard deduction.
And some of your Republican colleagues, though, who nonetheless went through that process and still voted no here in New York State, one of them argued, for example, that on this issue of the property tax, that this law, even as it is finally in the final form that we're now living with, essentially takes from the high tax states like New York, New Jersey, California, and gives to people in the other states. So how do you see that?
Well, I think that the vast majority of people that have a heartburn in New York State, in my Republican delegation, were the downstaters, almost all of them except
Long
one.
Long Island.
Down Long Island, you can live in a 1,200-square-foot bungalow, and you're paying $30,000 a year in property taxes. And, a family down there making what would be considered an amazing income up here are just barely making ends meet down there. So I understand. Really, there's two different states here. So there's downstate and there's upstate. And so for me, I looked at what it was for my constituents, and I didn't see that at all. But I can see how they felt that way downstate. And I understood why they voted that way. And if I was downstate, I probably would. But I'm upstate, and I don't live downstate like the vast majority of leadership in Albany does. And they look at everything through the prism of downstate. And that's part of the problem. Upstate needs help, too. I encourage a governor to do what we did, engage in cutting taxes. Because I think if they did, they'd be much more competitive. They wouldn't be ranked 49th in the country as far as business attractiveness. And they wouldn't see the continued outgrowth and out-migration of jobs. I think I saw a statistic recently where the seventh year in a row, New York State is number three as far as the tie three as far as the out-migration of people. So they have structural problems on the state level that they just will not address, and they need to.
Another piece of this bill, and of course, like any big bill, it's got all sorts of different pieces attached to it. But another piece of this was the elimination of the individual mandate for Obamacare. Now, you had been very vocal about not voting for simple repeals of Obamacare and in the absence of replacements for that. And so many analysts are concerned about that particular piece of the legislation and that it will undermine the entire premise of the Obamacare system and skew the insurance markets. How'd you weigh that particular aspect?
First of all, it's consistent with what I've done before because every single vote that I've ever taken in Congress where there was a vote to repeal Obamacare, I voted against. Mm-hmm. I voted against the party every single time because there's not a replacement ready to go. But I've also voted in the past to repeal the individual mandate separately.
Okay.
And I've done it because I believe that it's something inherently un-American, basically saying, you either do what we want you to do or we're going to fine you for something like health care. Now, will it impact health care? Perhaps. But I don't think that one of the premises of Obamacare is working. And that is they wanted to force people, especially young people, to get health insurance, to get healthy people on the rolls to offset the the higher age people like myself. Well, the bottom line is it isn't working. The people either they're not paying the fine or they're paying the fine and moving on. So I just don't think it's fair to those folks. Now, I will tell you that we have, and I've been at the forefront of finding a replacement for the individual markets that's going to work. It came out of what we call the Problem Solvers Caucus, which I'm a member of, and I'll be happy to talk more about it. And that's in the Ryan Murray bill winding its way through the Senate, and I'm a strong supporter of that.
Well, say a little bit more about that. Please. What are the provisions of that, then?
Well, basically, it's a fix, and without getting into all the details, it's a fix. But what it was is a bipartisan solution. And I know bipartisan is sort of a dirty word these days, but on both sides of the aisle.
Or a unicorn, perhaps.
Yeah, or a unicorn, right. But there's this thing in Congress called the Problem Solvers Caucus, which I'm a member of. And if you're a Democrat and you want to join, you've got to find a Republican. If you're a Republican and you want to join, you've got to find a Democrat. Huh. There's 23 Democrats right now and 23 Republicans.
So who was your pair? Who did you go in with?
Elizabeth Esty from Connecticut, okay. Who we're very good friends with. I'm very good friends with her. And so we came up with this plan to fix the individual markets. It has now gone to the Senate has taken it up. And I'm somewhat optimistic that might get some legs to it because I think it's something that could work. And we've done other things with infrastructure we can talk about as well.
I wanted to ask, again, a different question about the state and local deduction, but I wanted to turn this around. I'm guessing that most of the questions that you have gotten on this have come from why is there any limit on this at all, or, you know, seeing the elimination of the deduction as a problem. I want to flip that around because you did advocate to keep the deduction, and again, as you already pointed out, the bill originally eliminated that deduction and then ultimately kept it with a $10,000 limit. So I've spoken in the past to folks that come at this from a more Democratic Party perspective on this and push them on this, and they have struggled to provide a good objective reason for why, more generally, the federal government should subsidize taxation at the state and local level in the form of these deductions and other credits. I mean, what's the best argument, in your view, in favor of that? Because shouldn't states and localities, by most accounts, fully own their own tax policies, have their citizens pay the real cost of that, be accountable to those citizens for that?
This has gone back for about 100 years. And I think when the tax code was in its infancy and income tax was in its infancy, they allowed these sort of deductions to take root. And I think the theory back then was, well, it's a form of double taxation if you don't do that, if you don't allow them to deduct their state taxes. You know, there's arguments for that, and I understand the merits of that. And, you know, and I understand the merits of the high-tax states. I'm very concerned about some of the things that – how Congress views these high-tax states to some extent. And, you know, and I'm continuing to fight against them on many levels. But I think that's where the genesis of it came from. And I just see it differently for my constituents. I mean, I can put more money in my constituents' pockets, and when I can give the businessmen who hire my constituents the best possible opportunity they've had since the Reagan era to hire more people, I got to go for it, man. And I, you know, when I talk to manufacturers like Nucor Steel in Auburn, they said outright, not only are we going to stay here, but it's going to help us flourish here. And Auburn needs those jobs, man, and we need more of them like that. So that's why I did it.
I'm Grant Reher, and I'm speaking with Congressman John Katko from New York's 24th Congressional District. A couple other aspects about this law. In its earlier versions, the tax bill had several provisions regarding the tax status of graduate tuition waivers, undergraduate tuition remission, and private activity bonds. And all those things amounted to many observers as basically tantamount to a war on higher education. And you were also vocal about removing those provisions. My question is, why were those provisions in there in the first place?
Why did
the Republican leadership go there to find the savings?
Well, I think that there's some people within the Republican leadership, and I don't know the exact individual, but I know there's a sentiment amongst some people, not just on the Republican side, that colleges are living fat off the hog, and they're getting all these extra breaks, and it's ridiculous. So we're going after them. And I did not subscribe to that. And some people think that the private activity bonds were being misused for things like building sports stadiums for pro football teams, which I agree with to some extent. But that doesn't mean you eliminate them. You fix the problem. And so I heard it loud and clear from Chancellor Siverud. I heard it loud and clear from Linda Lemire over at Le Moyne and many others. And I went to bat for these kids. And I wish a camera was on me, because I harassed Kevin Brady every day on the floor of the House for the education issues as well as private activity bonds and the historic preservation tax credit, which was going to be taken out. That helped build that. The hotel of Syracuse would not have been rebuilt without it. So those things all got put back in, and I was very proud to be a part of that. And I think that we got to help higher education. We got to help these kids get their education. Lord knows it's expensive enough. So anything I do to help them, I'm going to do it.
You mentioned the federal historic preservation tax credit, and that was ultimately preserved as well. So, and that, I know, was a big concern for folks that are thinking about the development of the city of Syracuse and have been involved in the development of the city of Syracuse. So tell me a little bit more about how that tax credit works, why it's so important here.
Well, I mean, in upstate New York and in older parts of America, you have older buildings. I mean, in newer areas are just being developed, this isn't much of an issue. But for, like, the colonial, you know, the Northeast, for example, that's a much older area by nature, there's a lot more old buildings. And if those old buildings are degraded, but you want to fix them up and you want to give some sort of nod to preserving your history and spurring economic development, that's what that tax credit is for. So it gives you credits off your tax bill to invest in these properties. And Lord knows the Hotel Syracuse is a shining example of what can happen when you get that done the right way. And so older cities like Syracuse really benefit from it.
There are some now bigger, fairly speaking, nonpartisan criticisms of this law that I wanted to put to you and get your response to. They're more overarching.
Yeah, but I can tell you, say at the outlet slot, though, there's absolutely positively not a perfect bill. Far from it. But I do subscribe to the Ronald Reagan theory of legislating. And don't forget, Ronald Reagan was most successful, probably the most successful legislatively of any president in a long time since, probably. And he worked with Tip O'Neill, who was a hardcore liberal on the other side. No, people forget.
Yeah, he was a deal maker.
Tip O'Neill and the Democrats controlled the House, and they made deals on Social Security reform, immigration reform, tax cuts. That's amazing, right? With that structure. Imagine happening today. But Ronald Reagan always said, I'll take what I can get now, and I'll keep working on the rest. So whatever's not good in here, I want to hear from people so I can try and fix it.
Well, let me throw a few big ones at you and see
I'm
how
ready.
See,
come on.
See how you react to this. First of all, it does seem pretty clear that this law is going to increase economic inequality because it gives much more to the wealthy because they pay more taxes and they occupy higher tax brackets. And in addition to that, you've got the cut in the corporate taxes that you have talked about and defended. But nonetheless, one of the results of that is going to be providing more profits to shareholders. So on balance, I don't think there's any controversy. This is going to increase economic inequality. Does that concern you, and how did you weigh that there?
Yes, but I don't know necessarily agree with your fundamental premise, and I'll give you an example of why. A family of four, for example, making $55,000. That's a median income in Syracuse, by the way, $55,000 or Central New York. If you're a family of four, right, and you're making $55,000, you're going to get at least a $1,000 tax cut, if not more. And it's highly likely that that family of four paying $55,000 will no longer pay any income taxes or will pay very little federal income tax. So their tax liability is gone. Now you're talking about the others who are going to get their tax liability reduced. They're still paying a ton of taxes, but they're still paying some. This guy that's making $55,000 is not paying any. So I don't know about your fundamental premise, but the bottom line is I am concerned about this bill. And the thing I wanted to do most of all was to unleash the ability of businesses to hire more people, to pay them more, to give them and compete more on the world stage. And we have to give businesses that opportunity. Now, there's two types. There's C-Corps, which are going to have their tax reduced to 21%, and then pass-through corporations like Subchapter S, which is a vast majority of our constituents. Their tax liability is going to be reduced, but they're also going to take that money and reinvest it back into their businesses. They're also going to reinvest it back into their employees. And there's not a day that's gone by since that tax bill has been passed where somebody hasn't announced or told me that they're going to be paying their people more, they're giving bonuses, and they're bringing money back home. So I look at it as, yes, on paper, it probably looks like, oh, God, this is just a money grab. But you have to get these people more competitive on the world stage so they'll hire more people. And that's what we're trying to do.
Now, the second one is it also seems, I think, even more clear that this law is going to add significantly to the deficit and the national debt. And I think there's scant evidence out there that the economy is going to grow so much that it will make up for the difference in real terms in those lower tax revenues. So especially as a Republican, as someone who describes themselves as a fiscal conservative, which you have, did that concern you?
It does. There's no question about it, right? And like I said, the bill's not perfect. But I'm also I think that there's also a very reasonable opportunity to be able to grow the economy to such an extent that the vast majority of that deficit, if not all of it, can be ameliorated through growth. And some people say that doesn't make sense, but it does. I mean, let's face it, the last two quarters...
Well, the historical track record doesn't really suggest
I understand that, and I understand the argument. But, like, if your economy for, like, the last 10 years has been growing at a 1% to 2% rate per year, and all of a sudden it starts growing at 3% or 4%, then you got some, right? Now, look what's happened the last two quarters since we changed a lot of the regulatory structure in the U.S. and Congress. Last two quarters, we've grown at 3% rate. That hasn't happened in a decade. And this fourth quarter, they expect to be higher, close to 4%. Now, if that sustains itself for a while, I think that you're looking at a much lower deficit. But yes, it's not perfect. There's no question about it.
So I'll take what you just said as my segue to the third one of these and then flip this concern around.
You're flipping around a lot today.
There's I'm not running for re-election or challenging anyone for Congress. So I can flip. But there's a more subtle possible effect here that I've been reading about that I wanted to put to you. And that's this, that it's a concern about the timing of this law with the economic cycle. And the concern is that since it does seem to be coinciding with an uptick in the economy, which we're already seeing, mm-hmm. that this then in tandem could have an inflationary effect. It could overheat the economy and then ultimately result in a recession that we might have avoided otherwise. I was curious, were there discussions about that among
yes.
your colleagues?
Yes.
How did that get sorted out?
I think a lot of it, we looked at the trade imbalance, which is still acute, and we look at the amount of money that's overseas, which is particularly acute. And I'll give you an example. I was talking to a businessman, and I don't know if he wants me to use his name, so I won't, but I asked him here, and he has a substantial amount of employees, and he has a substantial amount of his money overseas and a substantial amount of employees overseas. He says, if this bill passes, I will bring jobs back. I will bring a bunch of my money back, which we haven't talked about, which we need to, and I'm going to invest because of the way the accounting schemes, I can have instant write-offs of your money you invest in your company. I will invest more money starting in January. So I look at that and I said, yeah, the economy's growing, and it's growing at a better pace than it has in a while. But we still have those trade imbalances that are colossal with our foreign partners. And we still have trillions of dollars that used to be here that are overseas. And they're overseas because it's not advantageous for them to come back here. So, yes, I still think there's plenty of room for this economy to grow, and I still think it's going to grow on a more sustained pace because of what we're doing.
Well, tell me briefly about bringing that money back. You said that was something important we should talk about.
It's called repatriation, and what it is basically the Apples of the world, the Googles, to name big ones, AT&T, many others. They brought their money overseas because if they bring their money overseas, they pay a much lower tax rate than they do if they have it here. So what this bill does is incentivizes them to bring it back here on a one-time deal at a much lower rate. And you bring that, repatriate those funds back here, you have so much more money to pump into the economy. There's so much more money that's available for investment, so much more money available for growth that I think it's really going to help the economy. Now, could it cause it to overheat? Perhaps. But I still think that there's an awful lot of room for us to grow. And when you look at the unemployment figures, for example, they don't account for the millions of Americans who have dropped out of the workforce, basically stopped looking for work. And getting them back in the workforce is a darn good thing, too.
Now, maybe the last question on this topic, a little bit different, more political. But Governor Cuomo has, in recent days and weeks, made some pretty threatening-sounding statements regarding those in the state who voted for the tax law in terms of 2018 in the midterm elections. So would you be surprised if he actively campaigned against you this year, showed up in your district?
No, but I'm not worried about it because, and I'm not being cavalier, I don't own this seat, and I didn't go to Congress just to get reelected. I went to Congress to lead, and I went to Congress to get things done. And I went to Congress to try and benefit my constituents. And if I get knocked out because I was able to get my constituents a tax cut and I was able to put this economy on the right track for a long time going forward, well, so be it. But so I don't worry about what other people do or say they're going to do or how they're going to do it. I think if the governor paid more attention to the fiscal infirmities in this state and was deeply as deeply concerned about our trade imbalance, our national trade imbalance, I'm concerned about that. If he was as deeply concerned about the fact that New York's 49th out of 50 states for attractiveness for business, I think he'd be better off.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and in this special hour-long edition of the program, I'm talking with Congressman John Katko. He represents New York's 24th Congressional District, and he was one of the members of New York's Republican delegation to vote in favor of the recent tax overhaul. Let me take one more question on this, and I want to take another run at the economic inequality piece of this, because there is an aspect of this that I think you may be giving short shrift to. The one of the concerns is, in recent decades in the United States, there has been quite a growth in economic inequality, and it's been driven by what's happening at the very top of the continuum. So those at the very, very top are getting incredibly wealthy, and the rest of the distribution is roughly staying the same. I mean, that's an oversimplification, but I think it's basically true in broad strokes. And so the concern is that, again, because of the way the tax cuts are structured and because of the fact that, as you talked about before, people at the top are paying more in taxes, that it's going to exaggerate that even more, that this is the wrong, in effect, to boil it down, this is the wrong time to add that aspect to the economic distribution, to further exaggerate that distance between the very top and the rest of us. I mean, it's kind of like what Bernie Sanders has been talking about. So I want to get your sense of this, because one might have a concern of, look, if there's a fundamental imbalance in the American political economic order, why would we want to, in a sense, goose it further?
Yeah, I mean, I just don't agree with your premise. Again, I mean, think about it. One of the reasons in the last 20 years people feel like they're working harder and taking home less, well, think what's happened. We've lost jobs out overseas, right? And we've lost the ability for companies to pay full pensions. We've lost the ability for companies to afford health care. And so what happens? We come on, and now in day and age, a guy who worked 10 years ago at a factory and had full pension and he had full health care is now maybe making marginally more, maybe, but the economy for the last 10 years is so stagnated that the business and health care costs keep going way up, that the average middle-class person is getting their butt kicked because they're having to pay more and more of a percentage for their health care. Their deductibles are higher, and their opportunity for growth and their jobs aren't there because the economy's not doing well. So all those things factor in as well. I don't think it's just like the rich are getting richer. Yeah, I think some of the corporate salaries are absolutely immoral. They're absolutely ridiculous, and they shouldn't happen. And if I could change that, I would. I'm open for ways to do that. I used to work at the Securities and Exchange Commission, and I used to go after these guys that for corporate cheats all the time. But when somebody decides to pay someone $80 million and you're trying to make ends meet as a middle-class parent, I understand how people fail away, no doubt. But I would argue that this bill gives them opportunity to change that. It gives them more money in their pocket. But more important, it makes companies healthier. And if companies are healthier here, maybe some of that stuff will come back. Maybe the health care costs won't be so high. Maybe they'll get their retirements a little bit better than they were before. And maybe there's more opportunity out there. But yeah, you're right. Some of these guys in the top of the corporations are pigs. There's no other way to describe it. It's how much money do you need, really? You know, and I think it's ridiculous. And they're reinforcing that perception. But I think this tax bill, ironically, helps address some of that.
Well, let's leave the tax bill aside now. Okay. And I wanted to ask you to tell me just simply about some of the other things you've been working on in the past year. What are some of the most important initiatives that your office has been focused on and trying to get some results on?
Okay, opioids, healthcare, mental health issues, to name just a few. And, of course, I'm neck deep on anti-terrorism issues, trying to keep this country safe. But let's just start with the opioid issue. Okay. It's awful. And, I can't tell you my parents that I've met and how many families I've seen destroyed by that drug. And one of the key components of causing the deaths now. Now, this show is an hour long. Statistics will show that within this hour, 5 to 7 people will have died from a heroin overdose in this 1 hour.
Hmm.
That's amazing. And the vast majority of the heroin is being laced with synthetic drugs. Synthetic drugs are far more potent and they're far more dangerous. And we do not do a good job keeping up with them. So I've got a major bill that's landmark legislation that's, I'm cautiously optimistic is going to go in the next month or two to a vote. That's winding its way through Congress, where it will basically, from the moment you identify a synthetic drug now to the moment it's listed on a drug analog statute and therefore illegal, can take as long as 4 or 5 years.
Right.
And so what I'm going to be able to do is do that within 30 days. And giving law enforcement the opportunity to do that. And it's really a turbocharging that process. And that's really going to help because as all the bad guys do is they change the chemical composition. You got to start all over. This, you keep ahead the way. So that's a big thing. Our mental health task force, which we had, is got some great things going on with it. And I think because of our efforts here locally, we've not only exposed the issue, but we're starting to get results, especially in the pediatric mental health arena where there's basically no beds for kids here if you, you know, for the average person. So Upstate's going to step up and do some things, and I'm excited about that. And I work on that down in Washington, and, you know, my terrorism stuff is really big. I'm doing a lot with that. And when I work with the Problem Solvers Caucus, is probably one of the biggest things I'm excited about because I was made co-chair of the Committee for Infrastructure, and next week we are coming out with a very major infrastructure package and parameters that we say that we're going to go to Congress and we're going to go to the president and say, you just have 46 votes here, 23 Democrats, 23 Republicans. It's bipartisan. Here's how we think you should fix the infrastructure issues in this country, and we're ready to roll, and we're ready to support whomever does this. And we need bipartisanship in Congress, and my work in the bipartisanship arena is pretty good, and I'm excited about that. And I was also, lastly, I was elected head of what's called the Tuesday Group, which is a group of moderate Republicans. There's 50 of us and 50 of my colleagues, many of whom have been here for 20 years. And I've only been here three. I'd like to be the head of it because they know I'm working hard to be bipartisan, and I'm really proud of that.
Tell me a little bit about the infrastructure bill that your group is putting forward. What are some of the basic parameters of it?
Well, break it down a couple of different ways. First thing, we analyze, we've analyzed and made suggestions on how to streamline the funding processes and not raid the funds once you have them set. Number two, and part of that also is to streamline the administrative approval process. And like, what best example that we can think of is 81. Since I've been in office, they've been wrangling over whether or not to include a tunnel option in the final analysis, just to get the analysis done, a draft environmental impact statement. That's 3 years. And we're going to wait another year, 4 years, before we get the three options laid out side by side. Why does it take 4 years to get the options laid out? That's crazy. Speed that process up and then get things moving, because a lot of money gets wasted. And those are kinds of things. Now, the other thing is the highway bill. We say it needs to be properly funded. We give a bunch of different ways to do it. Mm-hmm. And, we don't recommend any particular way, but there's a lot of different ways to do it. We engage all kinds of industry groups and consumer groups. And then we look at the other infrastructure issues like water and sewer, and again, water quality, like the harmful algae bloom issue we had here, airports, sewer systems, I'm missing a couple, broadband, and several others. And we know that's something that the White House will be interested in, because they want to do an infrastructure bill, and they look at the highway bill and then everything else separately. So do we. But we do it in such a way that says, here's 46 votes, man, to start with. Let's go. And I'm excited about it. I'm excited to be a leader about that.
Now, I wanted to also ask you about what plans you have here in the district for the upcoming year. And you have received, I think, a fair amount of criticism over the past year regarding the town meetings. Mm-hmm. It's been a big issue. The criticisms have concerned the number of them, holding them in person as opposed to on the telephone, having them done in a completely open fashion, and so on. So tell me what your plans are, at least at this point, for 2018 in terms of town hall meetings or the equivalent type of public events.
Well, first of all, we've had them since the beginning. And when you say that, it's kind of assuming that it's true. It's not.
Okay.
And I think that my opponents have advanced that and said, hey, he doesn't have open town hall meetings. Well, I'm not going to have an instance where people are just going to come in and with placards and signs and scream and come and, say all kinds of things and create theater. Okay. So what did I do for that? Not only do I have meetings on with veterans and that are open to the public and are announced to everyone I've been in every county in the last year doing that, and I'm going to continue to do that. I even went to the extraordinary step of saying to TV stations, hey, live TV, you guys pick who comes, you guys pick the questions, and I will take whatever you ask. I will not have any heads up as to what it is, and it'll be live TV. There's no chance for me to get away with anything.
That was the one at OCC, correct? Yeah.
I don't think there's a congressman in this country that's done that.
So what are your plans for 2018?
So I'm going to do the same type of stuff.
Okay.
Maintain the same type of stuff and continue to engage. And of course, whoever my opponent ultimately is, we always sit down and have a series of debates that are live on TV. I'm going to do those too, because I've always done that. I'm going to continue to do that.
You're going to do the first one here on the Campbell Conversation.
Oh, sure. Of course.
and on this issue, I think people also are looking for sort of details about what your plans are. So when you say you're going to have more of these, is there a ballpark figure you have planned? I mean, I know that, it may be impossible to give a number at this point, but, is this going to be a monthly thing?
I got to look back and see how many we've done. I know we've done a dozen and a half, I think, telephone town halls. I think close to that, almost a dozen and a half, maybe even more, maybe less, right around that area somewhere. And I know that we do like monthly or semi, every other month we do meetings in the public or every so often. We're going to continue the same schedule, and I can't tell you an exact number, but it will be definitely continue to be visible.
If you've just joined us, you're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and my guest is Congressman John Katko from New York's 24th District. Well, no interview with an elected official is complete without a discussion of the president. So let's talk.
I can't believe you're going to ask me a question about the president. That just shocks me.
So President Trump is finishing his first year in office. You were very critical of him when he was a candidate.
I didn't vote for him, I remind you, too. Yeah.
So how would you characterize his leadership as president now?
Spotty, for sure. I think that he does a lot of good things. I think re-engaging with Israel in a meaningful manner is great. And people can argue about the thing, moving to Jerusalem or not. That's every president, including Obama, has basically said, yeah, that's okay. But he actually did it, and people can argue about that. But re-engaging and making Israel understand that we have their backs in the Middle East is a very good thing. And re-engaging with in a more meaningful manner with Saudi Arabia is a very good thing. And getting them to understand that they're going to have to stand up for themselves is a very good thing. Getting them to take the gloves off and go after ISIS and help destroy the caliphate, that's a very good thing. But you know what? I would pray every night, and I pray every night, that he gets rid of Twitter.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about that.
Because I think his – and look, you know, you can say what you want about him as a person, but take a step back. The market is going at a remarkably good pace right now, and everyone's 401k is better off for it. The economy, like I said, is the last two quarters has grown at 3% for the first time in 10 years, and the fourth quarter is probably going to be better. And we have tax reform. We've had a lot of good successes.
If you took all those things and you didn't know who the president was, and I were to say to you, this is the condition under which your first year happened, what's your approval rating going to be? You'd get a different answer than what his approval rating
is. There's no doubt. His bedside manner stinks sometimes. Let's face it. And he says things that make your jaw drop, and he doesn't act very presidential. But a lot of people put him in office for that very reason. But I got to be honest with you, I think a lot of things he texts and a lot of things he spends his time on, and like the drama, like lately in the White House with the drama with Bannon. Mm-hmm. All those things detract from the things he's doing. And quite frankly, I've had 9 bills pass this term. 9, right? And I'm on pace to be at or as at least where I was last term. And last term, I had more bills passed than any freshman in the history of Congress. Very few of those even get reported because of all the air getting sucked out of the room by all the controversial issues coming out of the White House. Now, does he thrive on chaos? It looks like it. But is it unsettling for the average American? Of course it is. It's unsettling for me sometimes. But the bottom line is we in Congress are getting things done. We haven't taken our eye off the ball, and we're not going to. And I vote against him when I have to, and I stood up to him, and you wouldn't believe the pressure on me with the health care vote. But I stood strong, and I didn't take any crap from him or anybody. I said, I'm going to do it. And you got to do that, and that's the best way to make sure that things go the way they should.
Another question about the tweets, very specific regarding North Korea. I think that perhaps takes the concern to another level.
My button's bigger than your button.
Well, that you're really undermining national security there in a pretty profound way. Is that something that should be of concern to us? Beyond the, as you say, the drama with Bannon and all of that.
Oh, sure. I'm saying that I would not recommend you say that. But at the same token, you're dealing with someone, and I can't get into secure briefings, but on Homeland Security, I get briefings every day in the basement of the White House or basement of the Capitol, rather. And there is a significant amount of concern for that nation, North Korea, and a significant amount of concern over how much they're teetering on collapse because of their economy and because of the people starving. I mean, there was an article yesterday where troops are given leave in Korean, North Korean troops, so they can go forage for food. Hmm. Now, think about that. So it's a desperate situation, and do we want to push this guy over the edge? That's what scares me a little bit. But at the same token, does that guy only understand strength, perhaps, when I was a gang prosecutor? The only thing the gang guys understood was strength, and they understood that unless if I had the evidence, that was strength. If I didn't, then so what? So if you project strength, maybe the president thinks he's projecting strength, but I think it's probably not a good idea to start talking about things like that.
Is there anything else about President Trump's first year that that has particularly surprised you, either in a good way or a bad way, things that you weren't expecting on Inauguration Day?
That's a great question. I think we've accomplished stuff in the legislative side that, he'll get credit for, and he should. But I also think that there's things that he acts too off the cuff sometimes, And so it doesn't really surprise me how things have gone. But so I can't say is anything that's been a huge surprise for me.
And tell me about how you see the coming year in Congress. What do you see are the most important things, first of all, that Congress will need to address? And then where do you think we might see some significant accomplishment in terms of passage of something important, like the tax bill, for example?
Sure. I think immediately there's a couple issues. The budget and DACA is a very big issue, and we have to get that done by March of this year, or the hundreds of thousands of people that were brought here through no fault of their own are going to suffer for it. So we got to deal with that. And I'd be happy to talk about that more in a moment.
Sure.
We got to get the budget set, and we got to get the defense bill set the way it should. And I think that one opportunity for bipartisanship would be the infrastructure that I discussed, mm-hmm. and I'm proud to take a lead on that. And I'm on a transportation and infrastructure committee, and I'm ready to roll to take a lead on that.
You know, it's interesting, you know? Just to interrupt for a second, but as you say that, and I think back, with all of the other distractions, we've almost forgotten about that.
Yeah,
I mean, and that was
exactly.
One of the big issues in the campaign. It's interesting, but go ahead.
Well, that's a good example of why Congress has to help the president keep his eye on the ball, and that's what we've been doing. So when he gets distracted with things, we bring him back to the arena by saying, hey, and that's our job. And so my job is, and I haven't cleared this with leadership or anything, but we're gonna lay out our Problem Solvers Caucus proposal next week and say both sides should get involved in this. Now, am I a realist? Yes, I'm a realist. It's a campaign year, and the Democrats desperately want to, take back power, and Republicans desperately want to keep the power. So is there a possibility of tons of landmark legislation getting done this year? No. But there is one area where people can agree on things, and that is absolutely positively infrastructure. And there's things like DACA we got to get done and things like the budget we got to get done.
Well, you said that DACA is something that we should talk more about, and I agree with you. So tell me how you see that issue playing out. What are going to be the biggest obstacles to getting some sort of agreement? We've come close in the past but never really gotten there.
Yeah, I think we're going to get a fix because I don't think – and there's very few people on either side of the fence that want to see these people deported. So I think we will get a fix of some sort before the March deadline. I'm very, very hopeful of that. Is it a definite? No. But I think what we have to do to get there is everybody has to put on a Tip O'Neill and Ronald Reagan type of hat and say, I'm not going to get everything I want, but I'm going to get most of it.
So what's your sense of what will the ultimate deal look like? What will be in there and what won't be in
there?
The ultimate deal
is going to look like. My sense is that the conceptual outline to keep the people here will be there. And I think in return for that, there's going to be some sort of increase in border security. Whether it's a quote-unquote wall or not, I think there needs to be some border security. And that's something we've been working on in Congress is to try and find the parameters at. There's an awful lot of people on both sides of the aisle that basically can live with some sort of parameters. Some people don't want to have the word mentioned, a wall.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, I watched the news Sunday morning, and it was Face the Nation or something. And there was two Republican congressmen and two Democratic congressmen and women on. And one of the Democrats said, well, just we want a clean DACA bill. Just
right.
That's it. And I'm like, well, that's not – you know, that's not being realistic. If you want something where it's going to really help these people, if you have a bill that gets you what you want but also has stuff that helps us secure the border so that we don't have this issue happening again and again in the future, and I'm not saying build a wall, but just secure the borders better, I think that's reasonable to have that compromise. So if people think in a more conciliatory tone, it'll get done. No doubt my mind.
And I think it's important to get the terms here because you do hear this phrase, clean DACA bill, a lot.
Right.
So what exactly does that mean?
The clean DACA bill just means, well, they can stay.
Okay.
And not only they can stay, they get some sort of status up to impossible, including the citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's what they want, okay? Sure.
Do you think there will be provisions in terms of the path to citizenship that will be different for other people? Will there be, in a sense, a carve-out of lower hurdles here in this case?
I think something. I don't know if it leads up to it, including citizenship, but it will be something. Let me give you an example. The bill I co-sponsored from Carlos Cabello, a Republican from Miami, would be this. So if you're a DACA and you come out of the shadows, you basically tell us who you are and let's get going. And you got 5 years of conditional time here, right? And they got conditional status. And in that 5 years, you got to either be gainfully employed, have served in the military or gone and got your college education. And mm-hmm. after that 5 years, if you complete that, you will get a permanent residency status.
Okay.
And then you can go to back of the line and start, you know, maybe long term, like any other immigrant, try and get citizenship down the road. So those types of things I could see. But some people are going to want something in exchange for that. And so there's got to be give and take on both sides.
Now, I wanted to ask you some other questions about the Republican Party and your sense of it and where it's been. Do you worry? We're going back to the tweets from the president. Do you worry, given some of those and some of the fights that he's gotten himself involved in, and then you have candidates like Roy Moore, that the brand that you're in, the Republican brand, is being seriously damaged in the average citizen's mind?
Oh, I think in the average citizen's mind, both the Republican and Democratic brands have been damaged. Mm-hmm. And I tell you why. And I honestly and truly believe that. And I'll get back to answering your question.
Yeah.
But from a general standpoint, I think the far left and the far right have hijacked the legislative process and have led to this polarization that people are so sick of. They just want to see things get done and say, okay, we compromise a little bit. You know, you compromise every day in your marriage. You try to make things work, and that's how marriages last, right? We have got to compromise more in both parties. There's such a negative view of politicians because both parties are seen as the far left and the far right. And I think that those of us who are trying to operate in the middle need to keep pushing to try and find more bipartisan solutions to things. I think that'd be a really good thing. Now, does the president help us? There's an awful lot of people out there who hate the president so much that they may take it out on me, even without even knowing what I'm really about. And not without even knowing that I'm one of the most moderate members in the Republican Party, and I'm in problem solvers, and I do all these moderate things. So, yeah, sure, that's going to be tough. But, you know, the same thing's happening on the Democratic side. And, and it happened in 2010. Don't forget, they lost 80 seats, you know. And so being a party in power doesn't mean that you're going to stay in power very long these days, because people are sick and tired of the polarization and just the angry, arguing rhetoric. And if we can get back to a time where a Democrat is not a dirty word to a Republican and a Republican is not a dirty word to a Democrat, and bipartisanship is a friendly term, that'd be really good for this country. Really good.
But thinking about the Roy Moore case in particular.
Oh, I'm glad he lost.
Were you concerned about the way that your Republican colleagues in Congress, on the Senate side, I guess in particular, dealt with that? Because
yeah,
it was there was an interesting dance going on there in that.
Well, don't forget, not all of them felt that way. An awful lot mm-hmm. of awful lot of Republicans denounced him and said that he shouldn't run, right? So
now that could also be an example of what you're talking about,
right?
That they felt like they had to do that because
right.
of this polarization you're talking
you're
about.
You're exactly right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, it was because he looked at it from a strategic standpoint. Those who ended up backing him looked at it from a strategic standpoint. Somebody need this seat. Well, you don't need the seat at all costs. And that's my feeling. And will it be a real discussion this fall? And when the Democratic guy from Alabama is running against a Republican nominee who's not so extreme, like Roy Moore? Yeah, and I think then you'll see what's really going on. But that's politics. That's great. But I think that was an example. I think the Roy Moore case is really an example of the polarization of both sides. And I think that we've got to get back to some moderation here. Really do.
Last topic on this. It comes out of all this, kind of putting them together in a way. But you and I had a fairly long conversation about the tax bill. You explained, you know, your reasoning. Mm-hmm. I threw out some concerns that people have. You know, we had a back and forth on it. What do you say to citizens that are living this political environment? I mean, it's tough for elected politicians because of the things that you've described and, you know, the polarization and difficulty in working together. But how is it that we as citizens interacting with elected officials are going to break out of this? Because if you were, I think, you know, I'll concede this in terms of your pushback on my question about the town hall meetings. If you were just to open up in a town hall meeting, yeah, you know, it chances are it's going to become a shouting match on this issue. So how are we going to break through this? How are we going to get to a place where we can have more rational conversation? People can disagree without getting into some assessment of the other person's motives. We seem to be so far away from that. The model that the president is giving us is not going to help with that, because that's where he goes mm-hmm. when he has a disagreement. How do we find our way back?
I think doing what we're trying to do in
Congress
now.
3 minutes or less.
No, I think what we do, this problem solver is a good example. We have Democrats and Republicans. We start with just a handful of each. And now it's become like the cool kids club. People want to join. A lot of people do. And a lot of people don't because they say, oh, my God, I can't my district because I'd be done. But I think that's part of it. I think just showing bipartisanship and having the guts and courage to stand up in a bipartisan manner is really important. I also think we've got to take a look at redistricting on both sides of the aisle. When you have Democrats that are in seats that are 30 or 40% more Democrats than Republicans, or Republicans the same way, I think that from a structural standpoint, it's a race to, for the primary. So mm-hmm. they're worried about their primaries, not their general elections. So a Republican will sit there and say, well, I got to be more conservative than my primary challenger. And the Democrats can say, I got to be more liberal than my primary challenger. And they couldn't care less about their general election because they're going to win anyways. So I think that's part of the that's contributed to the problem for sure. But if every district was like mine, 5%, mine's 5% more Democrat than Republican. If everyone was like mine on the spectrum from 5% more Democrat to 5% more Republican, I think you have a lot more bipartisanship too. So I think taking a look at how the these districts have been gerrymandered on both sides of the aisle would be important too. And I think courts are starting to do that. They are doing it.
I wonder about something culturally, though, that relates to that. Because it's one thing to have, again, people who fundamentally disagree or they take more extreme positions because of a concern about a primary challenge. Okay, fine. That's one thing. But then it's another that when you get to the point of actually arguing with each other and having exchanges, you immediately go to basically what boils down to, you're a bad person.
Oh, yeah.
And that's why you're making the argument that you're making.
Oh, yeah.
So what you're saying is persuasive to me on one level, but doesn't fully explain it on another. And so how do we get out of that?
Well, I think that I think social media and the instant 24-hour news cycle has contributed greatly to that problem. Because there's the partisan news stations all over block on both sides of the aisle, and they whip up their people. Like I get things from people like, how dare you take full salary for life? How dare you get full health insurance for life? And why is it that you get free health insurance for your children for life, and I have to pay for mine? I'm like, what are you talking about? And these are rational, smart people. And I say, where did you get that? He goes, I saw it online. I'm like, well, we don't. We have a salary just like everybody else. We have a retirement plan just like everybody else. And last year I paid $1,300 for health insurance. So what are you talking about? So that kind of stuff. They see whatever they see online, they believe, and it inflames them and gets them so angry. You'd be stunned at how disrespectful people are to me, and I'm just trying to talk to them. It's unbelievable and at times threatening. It's amazing.
Last thing, just a minute or so left, but I suppose it's related to this in a way, or could be. We had a very interesting mayor's race here recently. Ben Walsh, first independent candidate winning in decades. What's your take on that, and what does it say about Syracuse?
I think it's great, and I think it's going to be great for the city. And I made a vow, no matter who got elected mayor, that I'd work as hard as I can to work for them, and I'm going to. And a matter of fact, I'm leaving here and going to a meeting with him and Joni Mahoney. It's our second one since he's been elected, and we're going to have one on every month. And we don't care what party you're part of. We're going to say, what can we do to help each other, and what can we do to help the city of Syracuse and County of Onondaga? And that's what it's all about. So putting your money where your mouth is, that's what it's all about.
Well, I think we all hope those meetings are productive. That was John Katko. Congressman Katko, I want to thank you for making the extra time to talk with me.
Happy to do it anytime.
You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO, Conversations in the Public Interest.